Today on Against the Grain. Israel and its boosters argue that it's an exceptional state in the Middle East and a necessary ally for the West. Its technical prowess is purportedly part of what makes Israel so indispensable, on full display during its assault on Gaza. But security scholar Reese Mackhold contends that the idea of Israel as an innovative pioneer obscures its dependency on the West since its inception, and he suggests that such mythologies serve to deflect attention from genocide. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Supporters of Israel have declared February 11th Israel Appreciation Day. America deserves a clear and honest understanding of Israel's story, said its chairman. This initiative calls on supporters to speak with clarity and pride. Israel has contributed more to the world than most people realize, and it's time to bring those facts to the forefront of public life. One of the campaign's key objectives in the face of international opprobrium for the Gaza genocide is to, quote, reframe Israel's identity by highlighting innovation, resilience, humanitarian achievements, and cultural contributions, end quote. To make sense of such claims, I'm joined by Reese Mackhold, Senior Lecturer in International Relations at the University of Glasgow and author of Fabricating Homeland Security, Police Entanglements Across India and Palestine-Israel, as well as a recent essay in Jewish Currents. Reese, why has emphasizing innovation been so important to the public image of the State of Israel?
So yeah, that's really, you know, at the core of sort of the motivation for why I wrote the original piece in Jewish Currents. I feel like, it's hard to think about the contemporary state of Israel and its various forms of sort of PR and marketing without defaulting to the word innovation. And there's many good reasons for that, not least of which is the sort of prevailing mythology of the state of Israel as the so-called startup nation, which is a mythology that's been sort of in place now for some time. And a key part of that representation of the Zionist project is to suggest that it is, quote, innovative in various ways, whether technologically or, as the case I focus on in the article, in relation to policing and military affairs. But that story, as I trace a little bit in the article, kind of goes back to the origins of kind of the Zionist colonization of Palestine in the late 19th century, where kind of from the outset, Zionist leaders from Theodore Herzl to others were sort of looking for a way to sort of sell their project to the world and look for various external, particularly Western backers at the time, and various iterations, whether they use the word innovation or not, have been there from the beginning, but have sort of been developed over time into the sort of contemporary, more sort of neoliberal associations with the term innovation.
And we'll talk much more about that history, but I wanted to ask you about the present. Israel's promotion of itself as on the cutting edge of security innovation has only increased since October 7th, 2023, which of course is when Hamas launched its surprise attack on Israel and Israel responded with genocidal violence. And critics on the left have argued that this period has been a boon for Israel's military tech industry and allowed Israel to promote and sell its advanced technologies of surveillance and of weapons around the world, you know, battle tested on the Palestinians. Does the last several years, when you look at it through the lens that you do, illustrate the sort of exceptional prowess of Israel's technology and military?
So, I mean, in short, I would say no, but for particular reasons that I'll kind of spell out a little bit. I think it's, you know, it's often forgotten, or it has been forgotten by many, including some on the left, that Operation Al-Aqsa Flood that happened on October 7th, 2023 itself, at least initially, kind of shattered the mythology of Israeli security omnipotence. Prior to that moment, many Israeli leaders had the luxury of kind of bragging that they were essentially omnipotent and could do as they pleased and had sort of things under control in an incredibly sophisticated way. As I think people will remember in the immediate days and weeks after that moment, that mythology was sort of very much in question, and many, including on kind of liberal presses like the New York Times and the Washington Post, sort of openly suggested that that sort of mythology had been shattered, even though they didn't necessarily call it a mythology. But as I kind of detail in the weeks and months since October 7th, the various forces, you know, that try to sustain Israel as a state and the broader project of Zionism have kind of gone into overdrive to kind of resuscitate that image in various ways. And as you allude to, part of that has been trying to sort of suggest that what's happened since October 7th have either proven that they were sort of powerful and sophisticated all along, or additionally, that what they have done has sort of proven new various forms of so-called innovation in the months and years since. And so in the piece, I kind of trouble this in different ways, not to suggest that Israel is powerless, far from it, but rather that the basis of their power is not all that it appears, and that in large measure they have relied, first of all, primarily on capital and weapons and resources from outside the state of Israel itself, but also that many of the things, the instruments that they've used to level Gaza and to kill tens of thousands of Palestinians have not been, in large measure, highly sophisticated. This is not to suggest that nothing is new, but rather I think the overarching picture, the one that I try to paint in the Jewish Currents piece, suggests that innovation is not all it seems, and that ultimately the key innovation is not really technological, but rather political.
Right. So just staying for a moment with what you just said, the presentation that the kind of assault that Israel has meted out against the Palestinians is high-tech, is precision, that it uses AI. Of course, that's language which one sees from states. Certainly the U.S. and its war in Iraq talked about precision weaponry, and it turned out actually to be quite different. When you look at the military assault on Gaza, how much of it seems to be the result of cutting-edge technology and precision, and how much of it is really more brute force military weapons and such?
Yeah, so I mean, just to be clear, it's a combination of many different things all at once. So there's not just one story of what it represents, but I think when you look at the images today of the absolutely catastrophically shattered landscape of Gaza, what you see is the core of what has been happening, which is incredibly brutal and in many cases not particularly high-tech destruction. That being said, it has been meted out at times with the aid of other things that are more high tech. For example, as you mentioned, AI. Early on in the genocide, there was, you know, some very significant reporting from outlets like 972 magazine and Israeli kind of lefty magazine. And they initially sort of showed how the genocide was being carried out through forms of, you know, what were basically called targeting through algorithms that basically identified particular people or groups based on certain forms of metadata and so on. So that is absolutely at play. That has in fact happened. But what I'm trying to sort of challenge, I guess, in the piece a little bit is the idea that the real story of the genocide per se is primarily about AI. As I see it, the Israeli government and its allies would much prefer us to talk about all of this as a story of high technology rather than as a story of genocide, which I think is the important story to focus on. Nevertheless, as many significant journalists have chronicled, the genocide has relied extensively on the use of data, also the complicity of U.S. tech firms, a range of different ones that I've mentioned in the piece, which have assisted the efforts by the Israeli state to compile data on Palestinians and try to obliterate them. So it's not to say that the technological story is unimportant, but I think in some ways to focus purely on AI is to kind of miss the point of the broader picture. And as some other researchers, for example, Shir Haver and others have shown, also the production of Israeli military industrial complex itself has also in some ways shifted over the past 2 years somewhat away from purely high-tech stuff and more towards sort of the brute production of basic weaponry in order to carry out the genocide. And I think in the last, you know, before the recent so-called ceasefire started, which of course is not really a ceasefire at all, one of the sort of, you know, most brutal expressions of this was Israeli forces kind of driving old decommissioned vehicles around Gaza and packing them full of explosives and leveling entire districts of neighborhoods and so on with that. And I think, you know, that in large measure does explain the visuals that were coming, that are still coming out of Gaza, which is to say absolutely shattered landscapes, which are have been in large measure destroyed through things that are themselves not especially high tech.
Well, as your writing suggests, this self-image and self-promotion of Israel as this cutting-edge innovator of military technology and high-tech in general, you know, doesn't date from the present, that it goes back decades. But I wanted to ask you, when you said that the story of what has taken place should not be one of innovation and technology, but actually genocide and the political will to perpetrate it and let it happen, I wanted to ask you, how does it benefit Israel to have the narrative be one of innovation and, in a sense, kind of exceptionalism? How does that benefit Israel in the present?
Yeah, I think that's a really important question and a really good one. I think it does so in a couple of ways. So, I mean, as I mentioned, the startup nation mythology of the state of Israel, it's no surprise that innovation is a cornerstone of that story. And I think the reason for that is quite obvious, which is to say, in some of the history that I trace in the piece that goes back all the way back to the 19th century, but it really sort of picks up a lot of steam in the 50s, sort of after the formation of the state of Israel in 1948. And the formal declaration of statehood after that time. What you really see with kind of what the work that innovation is doing for that project is to try to assert in some ways that Israel is not simply, you know, the object of Western largesse, which it, you know, obviously it is a recipient of significant amounts of aid, but they're always trying to assert in some different kind of way that they have something to offer back to the West in return. So, for example, I chronicle in the piece and in the early 50s how Israeli leaders were trying to, for example, sell their counterinsurgency expertise to the French in Algeria as a way to kind of market themselves as having something to return to their French patrons who had given them a lot of things, including some advanced weaponry at the time. So I think basically, you know, you mentioned the word exceptionalism. Innovation and exceptionalism really go hand in hand, which is to say, through asserting forms of, you know, by basically asserting that Israel, the state of Israel, is innovative, quote unquote, and that they have something innovative to offer the West and the wider world, they're able to sort of carve out a sort of exceptional space for themselves in the sense that they can assert the claim to being special, that they have something to offer the West and the world that no one else possesses. And you see that really in kind of the lead up to October 7th, that story of so-called innovation through exceptionalism, which is also kind of the story that I tell in my book, which came out last year, which is about kind of the efforts, particularly after 9/11, but before them as well, to try to market Israel, the state of Israel, kind of the progenitor of the homeland security state that we know today. And, you know, in the aftermath of the September 11th attacks, Israeli officials tried to assert that they were the ones who essentially had developed homeland security before the Americans and before anyone. And in there, you have kind of this claim to being both innovative, but also exceptional. And as I said, those two things kind of go hand in hand.
Rhys Mackold is my guest. We're talking about the arguments he makes in his essay, The Myth of Israeli Innovation, which you can find at againstthegrain.org. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain. So you mentioned that the mythology around Israel and its cutting-edge technology and autonomy goes back to the early days. And I wanted to ask you, going back to the earliest days of the Zionist project in Palestine, that is, you know, before the state of Israel was established, how is it dependent on Western patronage, which, of course, you know, erodes this notion of Israel's sort of maverick autonomy and innovation?
the word innovation sort of connotes a kind of self-standing capacities and things that are sort of highly unique and important on their, that sort of stand on their own two feet. And I think to go back to the history of the Zionist Project is to tell a very different story. In the very early days, as you know, the Zionist Project went more from just an ideology or an idea to a practical project on the ground in the late 19th century. In the earliest iterations, you know, the main ways which patronage helped or assisted was, you know, the following. First of all, obviously, a lot of capital was necessary in order to purchase land from absentee Arab landlords in Palestine, in historic Palestine at the time. That money came from a range of private sources, including private donors who decided to, you know, part with their money in order to fund the Zionist Project. So in that sense, none of it would have been possible without being able to initially buy land in Palestine and begin to settle it. But it also occurred in other ways as well, particularly in those early years. Initially, the Zionist settlers got some support from somewhat crumbling and in decline Ottoman Empire. But also as the British increasingly gained a presence in Palestine during that time, the British also offered Zionist settlers protection as they began to increasingly seize land and try to protect it through violent means. And so that kind of really carries on. You have other things as well in terms of the sending of weapons and so on. And that again picks up steam as time goes on. As I mentioned, by the 1950s, the conflicts with different Arab border states to historic Palestine began to kind of pick up speed, particularly after the Nakba, when the State of Israel is formed. And in that period, the importance of getting heavy weaponry from Western sources becomes increasingly important. And so in that sort of 1950s, 1960s period, there's a really distinct effort made by Zionist forces to kind of court the support of different, you know, Western states and empires. And, you know, by 1967, particularly after the Six-Day War, that has pivoted really to the United States, where the United States sort of takes up the primary role as the primary patron of the Zionist Project. But in that early period, it kind of ebbs and flows between different other sources of support, you know, France and Britain and other sources that kind of sustain it through that quite tumultuous time.
Well, you just mentioned the Six-Day War in 1967, when Israel achieved a rapid military victory over Egypt, Jordan, Syria, and Iraq. How did it become a kind of crucial moment in the flourishing of this notion of Israeli autonomous innovation and exceptionalism?
As I'm sure many of your listeners will know, sort of 1967 looms large as a moment when sort of the State of Israel sort of proved its military capacities, and the very terminology of the Six-Day War sort of connotes a highly rapid and successful effort to obliterate the military forces of a number of Arab adversaries in the Six-Day War. And so I think it sort of looms large as a kind of mythic moment when the State of Israel came into its own and sort of gained the status as a kind of potential model for others to follow. Particularly the United States, as the United States was kind of reeling from its own difficulties in fighting the war in Vietnam. And so in part of the article and part of my broader work, as well as the book, I detail the ways in which 1967 was kind of a turning point in turning the State of Israel into kind of the leading client state of the United States in the region, and how it came to be kind of a mini empire in its own right that was sort of deemed to be a crucial asset, a strategic asset for the United States and the West more broadly. But as I show in the piece and some of my other work, I think what's really important to note is that 1967, like the story of Israeli innovation per se, also didn't entirely stand on its own two feet, in the sense that what made it appealing as a kind of victory, particularly for the United States to look to, was not entirely just a question about the military genius of the attacks themselves, but rather it sort of offered a sort of salve to the American empire, which was kind of, as I said, reeling from its own challenges in the war in Vietnam. And Israel came to sort of stand out as a so-called alternative model to be looked at as a way to kind of fight these kinds of battles differently and more successfully. But as I kind of show in the piece, the idea of it as kind of an unprecedented piece of sort of military strategy is sort of more suspect than it appears, in the sense that there was really no contest between, for example, the air forces of Israel at the time and others, like its Arab neighbors, like Egypt, for example. So the idea that it was a sort of feat of military genius is something we shouldn't sort of take at face value.
Well, you just mentioned the ways that the great powers benefited from their relationship with Israel and the Zionist project. And, you know, earlier the UK and France as declining empires, then the ascendant empire of the United States, happening, of course, in the context of anti-colonial struggles and the Cold War. And you mentioned that Israel provided kind of another model for counterinsurgency for a state like the United States, beyond whatever lessons the U.S. felt like it could glean and the benefits of having the ally of Israel in the Middle East. How did the myth of Zionist exceptionalism that you've been describing, which has this whole technical component, benefit the West and especially the United States?
Yes, I mean, there's different ways to look at this. I mean, for example, in the war on terror, I think you can see this quite significantly, which is to say that as the U.S. got, you know, mired in different quagmires in places like Iraq and Afghanistan after 2001, and, you know, significant numbers of dead American service personnel were coming home, much like in prior moments like Vietnam, Israeli actors kind of inserted themselves as kind of an alternative model of counterinsurgency, which they claim to have done more effectively. So you can look at it on a sort of very technical level or a very sort of practical level. In the piece in Jewish Currents, I show, for example, that in the early 2000s, there were a range of sort of policy publications and strategic publications that, in the midst of these quagmires in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, went looking for alternative so-called models and lessons that they could glean and possibly benefit from. And they dissected what they called the Israeli experience as a way to kind of resituate the terrain of counterinsurgency and think about it more creatively or in a so-called innovative way. So on that practical level, you can sort of trace particular ways of doing counterinsurgency. So for example, at that time, Israeli actors often suggested that they had unique knowledge in kind of, you know, Arab culture or, you know, Muslim ideology or different kinds of languages and so on, that they sort of had a unique vantage point for sort of knowing the Arab or Islamist other. I'm, you know, somewhat suspicious of that rationalization. While there's not to say that there's nothing there, I think a lot of that isn't all that it seems either. And for me, the way I typically think about it is on a more political level, which is to say that the idea of Israel as an alternative model was enabled to try to resuscitate these campaigns and give them the new veneer of possibility and try to rescue them from themselves under the pretense of a new strategy. But I think, as is very clear, you know, looking at it from a little bit of historical vantage point, you know, decades after these campaigns first began, the Israeli lessons and the so-called model itself certainly didn't prove to be a solution to the war in Iraq, for example, and the counterinsurgency operations that unfolded after 2003. And so I think in retrospect, any sort of insights that were imparted are a lot less shiny, a lot less kind of glamorous and effective than they were initially sold as being.
Was the U.S. misguided in buying into this notion of Israeli innovation, technical prowess, being the necessary ally? Or was there something ideological at work, a kind of broader ideological commitment to the state of Israel?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I don't, probably some of the people who decided to take up the so-called Israeli model probably did in some ways believe that it held certain possibilities out for the American side. But I think probably a better way to look at it is that it's that idea of it as a model is beneficial for both sides, in the sense that it enables Israeli actors to sustain the idea that their campaign in Palestine has been highly successful, which I think is itself deeply questionable. And on the American side, it gives them a bit of room to maneuver as they're facing, you know, an increasingly large public backlash from U.S. publics. They can say, look, you know, we're not sitting on our hands. We're doing something. We're being innovative. And, it might buy them a couple months or a year before the reality becomes clear on the ground. So it kind of pivots back and forth between, offering an alternative model. And when that, doesn't end up landing in the way that it's purported to, that they come up with some other solution. It's also worth noting that, all the solutions that they came up with were not entirely or primarily Israeli. I mean, for example, the suggestion of, David Petraeus as a solution to the counterinsurgency, the notion of the surge, all of those things were equally mythic to the so-called Israeli model. They also didn't really work in the way that they were originally advertised, but they offered somewhat of a kind of room to maneuver for American officials and military officials in those moments where the pressure was mounting on them to have to demonstrate that something was happening that was positive, if that makes sense.
I wonder if you could talk about the notion of homeland security, which we associate with the administration of George W. Bush, but the idea of homeland security has a deeper history in Israel.
Right. So yeah, that's kind of the story that my book traces that came out last year. So, I mean, just to be clear, the term homeland security, at least that particular coinage of it in the term of putting the word homeland and security together, is something that is indeed American. And those two words had not really been conjoined prior to 2002 when the Department of Homeland Security was formed in the United States. But what I show in the book is that, thinking about sort of domestic security, preparedness, and governance through reference to the so-called homeland and sort of the attempt to kind of conjoin those two terminologies has a longer history in various settler colonial projects, including the Zionist project, as well as others like apartheid South Africa. And in the book, I draw a lot on the work of historian Amy Kaplan, who kind of traces the resonance of homeland to those other kind of settler projects. But what I basically argue is that, in the aftermath of the September 11th attacks, a range of Israeli and pro-Zionist forces sort of came together to try to articulate the claim that Israel has invented this thing called homeland security before homeland security was a thing at all. And they had tried to kind of leverage that so-called experience to pacifying Palestine and Palestinians as a kind of precursor to what became formally known as the Department of Homeland Security. And I trace kind of the ways in which sort of the origins of some of those claims, which are themselves kind of forms of exceptionalism as I frame them, but also how that exceptionalism sort of was conjoined with a broader rising industry, particularly after the September 11th attacks, that tried to kind of market the so-called Israeli model and the idea of Israel as a model to the wider world. And although the United States remains by far the biggest player in the global homeland security industry, Israel has long occupied sort of a position as a kind of node of influence or model that claims to be sort of at the forefront or sort of pioneering force in this broader story. But again, going back to the 1990s, a lot of these things were kind of already in place, but they kind of coalesced and came together in a very distinct way in the sort of war on terror period. And I show in the book how they kind of morphed and magnified and began to circulate to other places outside of Western power, particularly into India after the 2008 Mumbai attacks. So you can see kind of homeland security both as kind of a series of materials and things that are bought and sold, but also a broader set of kind of ideologies and ideas that are kind of traveling and circulating as a kind of ready-made so-called model that can be picked up and moved from one place to the other. And I try to trace that across different histories and different geographies.
Reese Mackold is my guest. He is the author of Fabricating Homeland Security, Police Entanglements Across India and Palestine, Israel. He's senior lecturer in international relations at the University of Glasgow. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain. So I wanted to ask you, now looking from the vantage point of the present, do we have a way of quantifying how much Israel has relied on the United States, has received patronage from the United States since its inception.
The specific numbers I lay out in the piece, but I mean, it's notable that, you know, Israel is the single biggest recipient of aid in total from the U.S. in kind of the post-war period. And that's a significant amount. We're talking about, you know, billions and billions of dollars. That has been the historical story, and that continues on into the present. So in relation to your answer, you know, how much does it rely on the United States? The short answer is an enormous amount. That being said, the story is a little bit more complicated than that, in the sense that that aid and largesse alone is not enough to sustain the Zionist project itself. In order for it to sustain itself as it has done in recent years, it often needs a lot of other customers. And it's worth noting here that in order to sustain its economy, selling weapons has been a big part of that. And the vast majority of the customers of Israeli products and services are not typically Western countries, but rather non-NATO countries, many of which are in the global south. India looms large here as the single largest purchaser of Israeli weapons. And so although the American willingness to fund the Zionist project is enormously important, and one that I think is really where our political energy should be at the moment, that's not to say that that's the only set of ties that sustains it. And Europe also looms large as a consumer of a range of Israeli products and services, including military technology and security technology. So it's not all just one picture, but in the Jewish Currents piece, I tried to, I guess, suggest that where our political energies and organizing energy should really be is on confronting kind of the primary arbiter of what's happening in Palestine and the genocide in particular, which I think is, at least in the present, the willingness of the U.S. empire to continue not just funding the state of Israel, but also sustaining its capacity to sort of evade any sort of accountability and operate in a way that is meaningfully exceptional, in the sense that there, it doesn't have to face any consequences of the action that it takes, both in Palestine as well as the broader Middle East.
Well, and not to turn that attention away from the United States, and we will, as we go, get to the political implications of the history that you've been drawing out in your book and your essay. But I wanted to ask you about other Western powers aside from the United States backing Israel. The support of Germany has been especially notable. And of course, there are fractures within European powers anyway, some stating their horror boycotting the Eurovision Song Contest, but in terms of real substantial impediments to Israel, much of that is really just ephemeral. How would you assess the support of European powers for the state of Israel? Obviously, that's not just one bloc.
Yeah, I mean, it's extremely significant. I mean, one example that's not military, although the military questions are very important, is, for example, in the world that I work in, rather, academic production and, universities and teaching, European funding, for example, a lot of that also goes to Israel as well. And I think that speaks to, the deep entanglement between the Zionist project and Europe. And that extends far beyond military affairs, though military relationships are deeply important, both in terms of European states being willing to fund and supply the Zionist project with the weapons and money that it needs to carry out the genocide in Palestine, but also in other directions as well. They both import and export various things that sustain the Zionist project, both militarily, but also sort of politically and ideologically. So my sense is that in sort of rigid economic terms, actually Europe at the moment, in terms of where Israeli exports go, is more important than the United States, but the United States is much more important in terms of military aid and other kinds of economic aid. I think, in the present, the signs that are being exhibited by Spain seem like the most hopeful, in terms of seeming to be willing to cancel possibly, billion-dollar contracts with the state of Israel. A lot of other countries, like, for example, Germany that you mentioned, although they've at times made some, said some things that seem to suggest that they're at least getting cold feet about being so in bed with the state of Israel, a lot of it has seemed to be kind of window dressing for the time being. But I think, you know, European publics in very strong senses absolutely are not on board with what their governments are doing. And that also kind of explains a lot of the repression against groups mobilizing in support of Palestine and Palestinians. For example, in the UK, where I currently live, the government's efforts to take on Palestine action with, you know, taking the gloves off and, you know, going full-scale legal attack on Palestine action speaks to, you know, the danger that these states feel that solidarity with Palestinians poses in terms of these material relationships and the capacity of, you know, British and European arms manufacturers to continue reaping significant profits by exporting things that are being used in the genocide.
You write, and you mentioned it earlier, that Israel has not just relied on states, although you argue that having political and legal backing by the West, especially the United States, has been the most powerful aid of all that Israel has received. But you also mentioned earlier that Israel relies not just on Western states, but also on Western corporations. Can you talk about the connections between corporations in the West, including the United States and Israel?
Yeah, so there's a range of ways that that takes place. You know, Special Rapporteur of the UN, Francesca Albanese's numerous recent reports have chronicled that in great detail, detailing what she calls kind of a shift from an economy of occupation to an economy of genocide. And in those reports, Albanese details the myriad ways in which various corporations, well-known corporations, are abetting the genocide and also profiting from it. In the piece, the one that I focus most squarely on is particularly American big tech, corporations like, you know, Microsoft, Dell, and others, you know, corporations like Meta. A lot of those corporations have been deeply, deeply complicit, particularly in, you know, sharing data and also sort of supplying the data sharing platforms that have enabled things like the AI systems to be sort of carrying the genocide out in different ways. And some of those have faced significant pushback, for example, Microsoft, which has required that they scale back some of their complicity in the genocide. But in broad strokes, you know, those companies are willing and able, or have been in many cases, to supply, you know, cloud computing platforms and other technologies to the Zionist project that have enabled it to do the things that it does. So even though in some ways the Israeli market is relatively small for these mega corporations, they have been very willing and able to supply the particular data sharing platforms and other high-tech resources that that the state of Israel has relied on to carry out the genocide. You know, there's all kinds of other things. For example, you know, earth-moving technologies used for housing demolitions in Gaza and the West Bank. That's a long-standing story. You know, corporations like Caterpillar is a sort of long-standing example of that, of corporations that are very happy to ship their products and services to Israel and get contracts to give the Israeli state the tools that it needs to carry out mass atrocities in the West Bank as well as the genocide in Gaza. So the list goes on, but I would certainly invite readers to look into Albanese's reports if they want a more detailed kind of breakdown of where that complicity lies.
You mentioned the unhappiness of publics in the West about what their governments have supported, and there's widespread opposition in Europe and even labor actions that have taken place in Italy. One might think that Israel's arms sales to the West would have fallen because of the genocide. Has that been the case?
Unfortunately, that generally hasn't been the case. You know, I think many people had hoped that that would be the case, but time after time, we've seen these unprecedented releases of new data on, you know, stock market figures from Tel Aviv showing that, you know, the growth of sales to a range of countries, including Western countries. Those profit statements themselves can somewhat be misleading in the sense that they can also be kind of hot air and kind of be somewhat misleading in the sense that they aren't always coming to fruition exactly as they suggest. But in broad strokes, the genocide hasn't really stood typically in the way of Israeli arms sales, quite the opposite. And, you know, the typical line that we hear is that because the genocide is basically being used in order to market these weapons and make them more, you know, more effective and more sellable and more profitable. That's a story that I've sort of complicated a little bit in the piece and some other work. But nevertheless, certainly, at least to date, with some exceptions like Spain, for example, we haven't seen a major turn against the Israeli arms industry. Though I think as time goes on, that's certainly a possibility and something that we should all be working towards in the sense of trying to, you know, move away from reproducing the idea that the state of Israel produces things that we simply can't live without and that it's sort of a military necessity. There are some things that a range of states have found incredibly useful to them. For example, you know, the Pegasus spyware is one particularly striking example that has been used around the world by a range of repressive governments to target their political enemies. And there's no doubt that Pegasus has been absolutely devastating to a range of activist groups around the world, including in India, where I've done a lot of my work. And so some of those tools have been marketed incredibly effectively and are really deeply damaging and really very powerful tools. But in many other cases, what Israel sells isn't necessarily entirely of a different category or different variety than what other competitors offer to the market. So in some cases, what Israel offers is not highly unique. It's sort of in line with what a lot of other producers are producing.
That notion that Israel is providing something that the West needs, that the West wouldn't be able to get if not for Israel. I wanted to ask you, flipping that around, you mentioned, of course, the crucial factor of Westernness, especially U.S. political and legal support. But I wanted to ask you about the United States and another Israeli allies, the role in actually providing military, direct military support to Israel during the genocide.
Yeah, so this has covered, you know, a range of different things, some of which I detail in the piece. You know, it has involved, for example, in the place that I live now in the UK, the UK government has, you know, supplied routine surveillance missions flying out of Cyprus on a literal daily basis and supplied that surveillance data to the state of Israel. In the United States, things have gone even further than that. It's, you know, covered a range of things. One thing that I focused a lot in the research for the piece was the support for sort of missile interceptions. While the state of Israel claims to be a world leader in anti-missile defense system, most notably through its so-called Iron Dome system, and has often sold itself as kind of a progenitor or innovator in that field. Actually, when you look at the news reporting over the past few years, when the state of Israel has faced significant attacks from foreign adversaries, including the Houthis in Yemen, as well as in its fight with the state of Iran, the vast majority of missiles that were intercepted and shot down were not actually shot down by Israeli forces or Israeli weapon, Israeli systems rather themselves, but rather Western allies, particularly the United States and I believe France in one case. And in some cases, I believe it's been reported that U.S. personnel were also on the ground in Israel to assist with some of those interceptions. And it's covered a whole range of other things like intelligence sharing, as well as the literal export of, you know, any number of thousands of tons of explosives and bombs, you know, aircraft parts, fuel, and all those kinds of things. So in terms of direct military ties, it's been, yeah, there's been a range of things from surveillance to, you know, literal shooting missiles out of the sky.
So the argument that you make and you've been making in this hour is that in contrast to the idea that Israel has been independent of the West, has been innovative, has been on the sort of technical cutting edge of military technologies, technologies of counterinsurgency that the West can benefit from, that Israel is an essential ally of the West. You've argued that Israel has been dependent since its founding on the support of the West, on funding, on military aid, on all sorts of partnerships, both with the state and with corporations. And I wanted to ask you why you think that dismantling this mythology about Israel's autonomy and exceptionalism is actually important politically, especially for those who would oppose or do oppose Israeli violence.
Yeah, so I mean, this sort of goes back to the question of innovation, I think. I guess what I would say to that, why I think it's so important to sort of challenge that prevailing image of innovation is essentially that, like, the only, you know, Israel is a highly unusual state in all kinds of ways. It's a small state, and it receives an enormous amount of support from a range of particularly Western allies as well as others. And I think in many ways, the only thing that really sustains the idea of Israel as a, you know, as a supposedly normal country and a productive country is the idea that it's exceptional and it's special and that it offers something to the world that no one else can offer. And so, you know, that goes through different iterations. It takes on different forms historically. It's not always called literal innovation, but one way or the other, the exceptionalist claim, I think, is what sustains the Zionist project ideologically and material, which is to say that, in, you know, if Israel is consigned to just being another state, it really doesn't have anything to offer the world, and it can't really stand, because it can't stand on its own two feet and is so dependent on these different flows and forms of impunity that are emboldened by its Western supporters. I think if, you know, the veneer fades on its image, then I think it's left kind of very much out in the cold and unable to sustain all of those kinds of ties. And I think, you know, the fact that its, you know, its allies and its supporters have gone into overdrive to sort of rearticulate the innovation story over the last 2 years alongside the genocide is a way to try to recuperate the exceptional image of the state of Israel as something special that we can't live without. And I think politically it's really incumbent upon us from the left to try to challenge that image, because I think if we're able to dismantle that image more successfully, the totally unusual state and sort of exceptional state of Israel in a negative sense, which I think is, you know, what we should be focusing on, becomes much more obvious if you take away the veneer of so-called innovation and kind of path-breaking success in these kind of technological feats.
You were just talking about how Israel has been exerting enormous effort to try and shift its public image around the world. And Israel has always been pretty active in that respect. But obviously, since the start of the genocide, that has become a taller and taller order as publics around the world have been horrified by what they have seen. I wanted to ask you, given there's a kind of vulnerability on the one hand in terms of Israel's public image, and yet, you know, on the other hand, elites have really doubled down in protecting the state of Israel. That certainly happened in the U.S. first under the Biden administration, assisting in the genocide, and now under the Trump administration, and so demonizing protest and making it very difficult for people to organize. Despite all of that, do you see that there are places of a special vulnerability for those who might be organizing against genocide? And I'm thinking whether it's people organizing around the corporations who are linked up with Israel, or people organizing on campuses about academic connections with Israeli institutions. Where do you see, if any, particular places of vulnerability?
Right now, I mean, you're obviously speaking to me from the United States. I think, not to say this is a special place of vulnerability, but I think the pushback against U.S. complicity with the genocide from the right is kind of instructive in terms of, in some ways, where these things can lead into actual significant confrontations that require recalibration. So I think the efforts, you know, by people like Tucker Carlson and others to challenge the sort of the idea that being in lockstep with Israel is good for America obviously have very problematic features in terms of how they are framed and sometimes are very anti-Semitic. But I think the ground is moving in terms of the calculus that Israel is a strategic asset that the United States cannot be without. I think that ground is significantly shifting on the U.S. right, and I mean, I think on the left as well, but I think you see it more acutely in terms of the way in which right-wing actors are reassessing whether or not that story of sort of being in lockstep and needing each other is all that it seems. But I think it's also worth thinking about kind of the idea, as you sort of started with the very idea about image making as the primary sort of locus of action. And I think it's important to note that, you know, the image crisis that the state of Israel is facing now is highly significant. And, you know, Zionist actors and their allies have gone into overdrive, as I've said, to try to resuscitate that image. But when you hear the likes of Hillary Clinton, for example, recently saying that the problem is not the genocide, but rather the TikTok in her image sort of misrepresenting the genocide as something that it's not, I think that shows about kind of the perils of looking at this all in terms of mismaking. And I think if we go back to kind of the origins of what's called Hasbara, or kind of Israeli propaganda or sort of strategic diplomacy in the 1980s, in the fallout from the 1982 Israeli invasion of Lebanon, that's where that whole idea that Israel's image was the primary thing to be managed, you know, that's where it arose from, and we're kind of living with that today. But what I think is, you know, quite notable about the last 2 years is how that project of, you know, manufacturing consent and myth making through, you know, very specifically propagandistic imagery and storytelling is really kind of falling on its face. And I think, you know, as Clinton's frustration indicates, people are able to see through a lot of that stuff. So I think that in many ways is what's shifting the ground. And that owes also in no small part to the fact that throughout the genocide, because other journalists have not been able to be in Gaza for the most part, Palestinians have been able to narrate their own story and show what is really happening through their own words. And I think that's been incredibly evocative and powerful in showing the wider world what in fact is really going on.
Rhys Mackold, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Rhys Mackold is Senior Lecturer in International Relations at the University of Glasgow, author of Fabricating Homeland Security, Police Entanglements Across India and Palestine-Israel. You can find his essay in Jewish Currents, The Myth of Israeli Innovation, at againstthegrain.org. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time.